and welcome to the Vocal Fries Podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
Happy 5th anniversary to you and us and me.
Oh, I know. It's like almost exactly to the day.
Well, actually, when this comes out tomorrow, which is my birthday too, it will be when we tried to release the first time. Like, we released it out into the world, but the word asshole got us in trouble, right?
Right. And yeah, in the description. Yep. So that's true.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're one day off of recording and exactly on.
Yeah.
Happy 5th.
5 is a big deal. What is the 5th anniversary? Is it like, is it like metal of some sort?
I don't remember why they do that thing, but. I know, like, the first one is paper, I think.
Paper, right. So wood is the 5-year anniversary gift.
I'm not touching that one.
I know.
So, yeah, in honor of our 5-year anniversary, what's happening?
Oh my god. We have a live event, and we have a very special guest.
Yes. Corey Stamper.
The lexicographer.
Extraordinaire.
Yes. The history of swear words. Cool person.
Very cool person. Taught us about hard pants and soft pants.
Yes. And moist talent of podcasts. I'll never forget that title. Sometimes I forget our titles, but not that one.
Yeah, because it's so kind of gross, actually. I mean, moist doesn't bother me like it bothers other people, but when you put it together like that, it's like kind of gross. But I like it anyways.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and we're going to be talking with her about the word bullshit. I feel like I've been seeing the word bullshit more since we've thought of talking about it, but that's probably not true. Or maybe it is.
Probably,
I don't know.
Probably not. You're probably just noticing it more because
of whatever.
You're like primed to.
Yes.
Because I haven't noticed any uptick at all.
Okay.
Okay. So probably.
I guess the episode will be not safe for work because we will be saying bullshit a lot.
I mean, our episodes are never safe for work. So.
That's true. So yeah, that's going to be fun. So we will post in the show notes and on our social media a link to a Google form or just ask you to put your name and email address, and then it'll give you a link to the Zoom for July 16th, Saturday, July 16th at 1 p.m. Pacific time.
Right. Just so that, you know, we figure you're probably going to be safe if you sign up for it.
Exactly.
And if you aren't safe, we'll kick you out. It's fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're going to teach me something about Alaska that, for some reason, I have been completely out of loop on.
Yeah, well, so I've been just paying attention to, like, voting and election stuff because...
Because your country is about to become not a democracy if you...
Exactly. Yeah, I guess, you know, like, maybe I should just, like, keep an eye on it. So, last month, Alaska had a special primary. So this is just, like, remarkably bad. About 1 in 8 rural Alaska ballots have been rejected in the special primary.
Holy, that's a really high percentage.
It's really high. This is really bad. So I clicked it because I saw that. That's all. So the headline was just that, saying that. And I was like, okay, it's rural Alaska. Is this going to be an issue with indigenous, but the Alaska natives?
The native Alaskans?
Yeah. And so I was right. It looks like there's like a number of reasons. Alaska's first ever statewide election by mail. Okay, so you have your first ever statewide election by mail and thousands of ballots are being rejected. And it happens to be 1 of 8 rural Alaskans mail-ins being rejected. The Senator Bill Walikowski are saying that these are occurring predominantly in rural Alaska, huge native populations, and in low-income areas of Alaska. So these are just populations that are underserved in lots of ways anyway, right? And so that's, like, not good. But here's another problem that they brought up is that there is no outreach to Alaska Natives, not in the way that it's done to other populations. And, of course, that's, like, a breakdown of democracy. If, like, there is a population that is not, you know, it's being ignored. But... it's also an issue of, are these ballots, like, readable to people? Are they accessible language-wise? Is it easy to understand what to do with the ballot once you have it? And so this is definitely, you know, an issue of language. And
what are the rules in Alaska? Is it just English, or do they provide ballots in any other language?
The language assistance people are sent materials in the native language, but materials that the person has that needs help with are in English.
It seems like the language assistant is going to help someone at the polls.
Yes.
Not so much with mail-in ballots.
Right. So there's this lack of this language assistance that can be provided because you're at home. Again, this is like looking at equal protection under the law and all of these things. You should have equal access to voting. And this is unequal access to voting if you cannot understand the materials. And even if you, you know, it's like, if you're bilingual, you may just want that material in, you know, not the language other than
English. In your more dominant language.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I see from this article from last November that soon you'll be able to register to vote in Yupik.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's good. And the other languages
that's a step up.
That you will be able to vote in, to register to vote in will be Navajo and Apache.
Okay.
So that's one step. But again, once you get the materials, how understandable or how comprehensible are they to you? So yeah, it just brought to mind that there's definitely not equitable access right now. All these steps in place to disenfranchise voters, it's not an accident. I'm glad to see these steps, though, you know, for Indigenous voters, certainly, for any population that has been disenfranchised historically. I hope they figure it out by the, I don't know if they're gonna be able to figure it out in a couple months.
Well, you heard that in Wisconsin, they got rid of the drop boxes, right? The Supreme Court ruled against drop boxes.
Oh, so like same day bringing in your ballot?
It's not the same day. I think it's early voting, but it's not mail-in. It's more dropping it off. So they
okay, yeah. But you get it in the mail and then you drop it off.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah,
the
yeah.
That's yeah. Ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm sorry to tell you, things are really bad.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So many things leave me exasperated, and you're right. It's really bad here right now, and sometimes I pretend that nothing is happening.
You kind of have to like, stay
you
stay
have to
sane,
survive.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a survival mechanism at this point.
So anyway. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that things are not going to continue to disintegrate down there.
Thank you. Thank you.
But I have to say that I'm somewhat dubious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things have just, I mean, the Supreme Court is like is a nightmare now. It's like 100% a nightmare, so.
Yeah. Yeah. You're dubious. I'm dubious. My stress hives are dubious.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Seriously.
So, anyway. But you know what? We have a fucking amazing episode for everyone today.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I mean.
He is such a charmer. I've met him in real life, and he's, you know, charming in real life, charming on over Zoom.
Yeah.
Just wow. And such great stories, such interesting stories.
I know. We have the John Rickford for y'all today.
The. We're very excited to have Dr. John R. Rickford. He received his BA with highest honors in sociolinguistics from the University of California, Santa Cruz in 1971, and his PhD in linguistics from the University of Pennsylvania in 1979. He won a Dean's Award for Distinguished Teaching in 1984 and a Bing Fellowship for Excellence in Teaching in 1992. And the primary focus of his research and teaching is sociolinguistics, the relation between linguistic variation and change, and social structure. He's especially interested in the relation between language and ethnicity, social class and style, language variation and change, pidgin and Creole languages, African-American vernacular English, and the applications of linguistics to educational problems. But the reason that we have him on today is that he's also the author of Speaking My Soul, Race, Life, and Language. So welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much for being here. We're really excited to talk with you.
So the first question I have is, why did you want to write this memoir?
I retired on August 31st, 2019. 10 days later, I had a stroke. And I came face to face with my mortality. If I had not been at Stanford, I would probably not have been here. Because my father, and two of my brothers, two of my three brothers have died of strokes.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And I had very excellent doctors who took care of me, and I survived. But I spent about a week at Stanford Hospital, and then about another week in a rehab center. And I really wanted to write a memoir. I thought if I did nothing else, I wanted to leave something for my family and friends, and maybe even publish it about some significant, you know, events in my life. So I actually got permission to go to a brand new course that was being taught at Stanford in the evening on writing a memoir by Rachel Herron. They allowed me to go, although they were very, they were tracking me throughout the time. Are you coming back now? Are you not coming back now? but I finally got home. And that course was wonderful. It taught me a lot. And I made some friends, a small group of friends in the course. And we continued to meet after the course was finished about, you know, exchanging drafts of memoirs and so on and so forth. Luckily, Routledge said they would publish it. As I like to put it, I labored joyfully over the last 2 years writing this book. And it's wonderful that they allowed me, you know, I have over 70 pictures and illustrations, a very long index. So it's unlike most memoirs.
Yes.
There are not many in linguistics. You know, David Crystal notes this in his book, just a phrase I'm going through, that they're very rare in linguistics. I really feel privileged to have one, you know.
Well, how different was it to write something like this versus all the academic articles you've written?
Yeah, well, of course, a lot of things in my book, they don't have anything to do with language per se. You know, I think my second chapter is about a monkey and a rabbit that I had as a child, who I don't know how. I got them from a neighbor along the street. And this monkey, a marmoset monkey and rabbit, they always lived together in the same cage. And they used to snuggle up against each other. And they used to play together and so on. And eventually, the monkey was out of his cage one day and he got bitten by a dog. I took him to the vet and everything. He used to ride around holding on to my hair, you know. And he loved the breeze and so on. But he died. It was very sad for me. But the rabbit afterwards just refused to eat. And I got in the best kinds of zeb grass that he could, you know. I knew what kinds of grass he liked and so on. But after about 3 days, he just died of a broken heart. And that was doubly catastrophic for me. So I have things like that. I have a chapter on John Agard, who the people in England will know well as a poet. You know, he received the Poets Award for poetry. He and I had a little, let's call it incident in our teenage years when we were going wrong by these two Indian girls, East Indian girls that we'd met at the party. We were trying to attract their attention. We were singing little songs and, you know, it looked kind of ridiculous. We had on raincoats. It was not raining. And eventually we decided we had enough of that. But neighbors thought that we were thieves. We were going to steal fruit from the parents' fruit trees. And they called the police, but they also assembled a little group that would try to capture us and beat us up if the police didn't come in time. And when we got ready to leave, they ran across the street, but the police came just in time. I stopped, John Agard didn't, and they pointed a gun and said, "Tell your friend to stop or we shoot." And I yelled at him to stop. Luckily, because he's a huge poet in England. And we went to the police station. We were kept in a holding cell for several hours and so on. So I talk about that too. And Agard had written a calypso about that incident, which I also include. So I have things like that. I have things about my family, of course, a lot about my family, about my identity. I talked when I came to the United States. I talked about going to UC, University of California, Santa Cruz. But then I also have chapters on how I fell in love with linguistics and Black talk. And I talk about David Aberdeen and Dennis Brutus in England, who fought against segregation in sports in South Africa and was shot by the police and was in a cell next to Nelson Mandela. And I have a chapter on Rachel Jontel, who was the star witness in the trial of Zimmerman for the murder of Trayvon Martin. So it goes all over the place. Some chapters are much more about language than others. But it is designed to be readable. But, you know, linguists think all kinds of things are readable.
Yes.
And the phonology of why. But you only see the eyes start to glass over, you realize that nobody's really understanding you.
Yeah. So I do. We do definitely want to get to, you know, Rachel Jontel and all of those first. Before we get to that stuff, I do want to talk a little bit about what it was like growing up in Guyana, and also like the transition from there to the United States. What that was like for you?
There are many parts of that I can answer. If you look, I have a picture in this book of my teachers, the staff at my school. It's called Queen's College, my high school, and probably the first thing you would notice is, of course, except for two Asian teachers, everybody else is basically Black or Indian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was very different from the United States, and sometimes that's a small point, but I think very often colleagues at Stanford, when you think in terms of trying to hire, let's say, an African American person in the department, they think of it as very unusual. I mean, you have to take a chance with this person. And that's completely the opposite of what I grew up with. I grew up with people who were brilliant, and they were people of color, because basically everybody was a person of color. I can go into that more. I did have one English headmaster when I was there. It was just the transition from being a colonial entity to becoming independent. The heads of all departments, government departments, used to be British, and the heads of, you know, school, like our school used to be British. But that all changed when I was at school and became independent in 1966. So that's one thing. Secondly, as my chapter on forebears and so on makes clear, I was regarded in Ghana as a mixed race person. So that later on, not much later, and had my DNA tested. I was like 34% African ancestry, probably about 13% Indian, East Indian ancestry, some Amerindian, and then about 48% to 50% white ancestry. Which, by the way, is, as I noticed, I note, is about the same as Henry Louis Gates, you know, of finding your root fame. So I would be what you would call, at that time, you'd call in Guyana, a red man, or a red mulatto, to use the phrase that used to be used.
Right.
And in the 19th century, there was a whole series of these distinctions that were made. So you had a Sambo was like 1/16th white, Mussolini was 15/16th white, and mulatto was the term halfway, you know. So
yeah.
the system fell apart, but the notion remained. So in Guyana, at the time, you weren't really considered Black unless you were decidedly a Black. You had 80% or more African ancestry. And John Agard was very similar. I think his dad, who I never got to meet in person, was black, and his mom was Portuguese. But when I came to the United States, it was a totally different picture. In the United States, basically, as they say, it's a one drop principle. And a wonderful book, if you had video, I could show you, by Yaba Blay, called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. And she has interviews with many, many people of different shades. But I had much more than one drop. I had at least 34 drops. 34%. And, you know, when I went to Santa Cruz, immediately all the black students started calling me, brother, hey, brother, what are you doing? No, sound. And I also had a few incidents where sometimes with the police, sometimes with other people, it was clear that they regarded me as black and as a threat in some way. And so I gravitated to the black students at Santa Cruz. And in fact, I later became president of the Black Students Association. So my identity changed from a mixed race, a red man, to a black person. And I have a whole chapter where I talk about a letter I wrote to my dad saying that, you know, this is my new identity. And I could tell I wrote it when I was a sophomore because it was sophomoric. I can walk this earth alone. You know, I am a member of the human race, and so on and so on and so on. My father was a really big person, and he wrote a letter saying, "Forgive me. I meant no such harm as you envisage." So it's a very powerful personal chapter. Mm-hmm. And by the end of that summer of 1969, he died from a stroke. Mm-hmm. And I remember that when I was leaving Guyana, I shook his hand, and he said, "Are you too big a man to give me a kiss? You know, I'm going to shake my hand." Of course, I gave him a kiss, but I really regretted that because I was never able to afford to fly home for the funeral. So that was the last time I actually saw him. Two things happened. I switched from literature to linguistics. Mm-hmm. I discovered linguistics at Santa Cruz, and I switched my identity. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was going to call the book Transformed or something like that. But for various reasons, we decided that Speaking My Soul was a better title. And it resonates with another book I've written called Spoken Soul, which is widely used at universities and so on. When I first came, I was totally on the periphery of things, with black things and things in general. And over the years, I went much more into the center through Herman Blake, who was a big influence on me at Santa Cruz and still is. I met Huey Newton, you know, co-founder of the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. And I went home with Professor Blake. I got to know him a little bit. I met, of course, Rosa Parks. We bought the Stanford. And she came to our home and played with our kids. And she gave some powerful speeches. I met August Wilson, who is a fantastic user of the Black vernacular. You know, his plays are just amazing. They're all rich in the vernacular. And this is very different from the person he was at the beginning, you know, where he would try to use high-flown language, but it didn't really work effectively for him. And I met Oprah Winfrey, I met Dennis Brutus, who was a very important figure in South Africa in the fight against apartheid. So in many ways, I became more involved with some leading figures in African-American community. And of course, I became very involved because a lot of my recordings were of African-Americans in the West, like East Palo Alto, which is across from Sanford, and on the Fuske Island in South Carolina, the islands, where they speak color, and in Philadelphia. So I got to know people across the spectrum of your African-American experience. Mm-hmm. And I became chair of African-American studies. So, you know, I got involved and I feel grounded in a way that at first I wasn't grounded at all, you know. I'm sorry to talk so long, you know.
No, that was fascinating.
Professor, you know, I can just keep professing.
I wish all professors were as captivating as you are, because that is not usually how I feel about it.
Yeah. Well, and I honestly know so little about Kiana and that their transition, like, some of that I could have guessed, but I didn't know, like, the full, like, ramifications of everything that would have changed for you. So that was mm-hmm. really fascinating.
Yeah.
It was a huge change. And sometimes it's, you know, looking back now, I'm 72, I guess, but you realize that, you know, I was 19, 18.
Yeah.
And of course, you took extreme steps. You know, I remember leading a march around Soledad prison. And I think about it as a parent. I think I must have been crazy, because there were the guards at Soledad prison, you know, with their rifles pointed down at us. Yeah. And there I was, you know, as a, leading this group of people marching around and so on. I wouldn't do that now.
the folly of youth.
Yeah, my son, he's a professor at Cornell, is much more radical and so on. And so I guess he would do that now, you know. I would similarly disapprove as my parents disapproved back in the day. But, you know.
In your book, but also as you were just talking now, you talk about how you fell in love with linguistics and Black Talk. So actually the chapter is called How I Fell in Love with Linguistics and Black Talk. So first, let's talk about linguistics. So what do you love about linguistics and why?
First of all, I designed my own majors. Luckily, Santa Cruz was a kind of crazy experimental place. Yeah. And in fact, they had no grades.
Oh, wow.
You got the evaluations from professors. Which in fact would be worse, because instead of a grade, they would have a whole paragraph. So if it was good, it was good. But if it was bad, it was terrible.
Right. Like, I'm disappointed in you.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyhow, sociolinguistics was just beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, that book by Fishman, Ferguson, Labov's book, Labov's book in New York City was 1966.
Wow.
So I began university in 1968. So, you know, I was very influenced by the novelty of the whole thing. In fact, compared with literature, which I loved and still love, you know, I thought of how difficult it must be to write something new about Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you can always find some little something, but, you know, whereas everything in sociolinguistics was brand new. And I read an article by Bob LePage, who was a linguist at York University, that had to deal with problems to be faced in the use of English as the medium of education in four West Indian territories. You can tell that's also old-time title, because nobody has titles that long these days. He said that, you know, students were doing badly in the exams. You know, we sat in exams that, as a colonial entity, that was set in England and were graded by people in England, London University, Oxford and Cambridge University, and so on and so forth. And he said that part of the problem is that the teachers in West Indian territory, like Guyana, Jamaica, and so on and so forth, assumed, as the British did, that students came to school speaking English.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they spoke this Creole mix of English and West African languages and Indian languages and so on. But of course, the teachers didn't like at all. And he said that what happened is that very often prizes went to the best mimics rather than the really creative students who were using their Creole. And he suggested that people should be trained to understand the Creole and to work with the Creole and to teach children in the Creole and then to transition them, you know, to develop another register in standard English. So I found that article very inspiring. And I basically put the article in one hand and I took a catalog from the University of California, Santa Cruz, in the other hand. Mm-hmm. And I selected courses in linguistics, in sociology, and so on. I must say, when I first began linguistics at Santa Cruz, in many ways, it was kind of boring. You know, I said, oh my goodness. But it was this strong sense of applying it to this larger problem of helping speakers of the vernacular learn to use the standard true contrastive analysis and so on, that really motivated me. When I finished my bachelor's, I was lucky to get a Danforth fellowship to go on to grad school, and I chose University of Pennsylvania, where Bill Lebov was. But I thought a lot about going to Berkeley, where John Compos was, and so on. And I thought about going to Stanford, where Charles Ferguson was. But I'd already taken a summer with Charles Ferguson, and I wanted to get more expertise in African-American English. Those were the factors. By the way, if I didn't get a scholarship, and I wasn't eligible for most American scholarships because at the time it wasn't an American. If I didn't get a scholarship, I was going to go back home and just become a teacher. I had taught at high school the year before, and I knew that once you need to get away and go and drink beers at the local. And I wasn't a good beer drinker. I couldn't take more than one or two beers. And, you know, the way 10 or 11 beers. So I thought that wasn't a good prospect for me. when I got the fellowship and I was able to do a PhD. And I forgot the question you asked in the first place.
Well, it was just like how you fell in love with linguistics, but I think you answered that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the thing is that, you know, from the beginning, you were finding things that nobody had known about before. Like, for instance, my wife and I, we lived in West Philly. And Philly is a funny town. People always ask you where you live, and they want to know exactly what street and so on, because it all means something in terms of the background and so on and so forth. And we lived near to 52nd Street, which was known as the Strip for various reasons. It was kind of a rough neighborhood. And we lived in one of these homes that are all joined together. You know, like East Coast cities are like that. We would hear a lot of people. It was black. The area was black. And you hear people singing in the night, like something like Boyz II Men, you know, mm-hmm. would intone in different melodies and so on. And we'd hear a lot of African-American English. And I asked about maybe in the first quarter or certainly in the first year, I said, you know, have you heard this expression with stress bin? People say, you know, oh, I've been at that. Or I've been told him that a long time ago. Oh, I've been telling that. And he said, no. And I said, wow, I hear it all the time. So I wrote a paper about that. And again, it was a novelty. You would hear there was a woman who had planned to move, but she was pregnant, that she was planning to move before she became pregnant. And the person said, let's say, Jillian better look out. She be done had her baby at 40 North 51st. In other words, she will have had her baby by the time she plans to leave. It's like a future past perfect, right? Mm-hmm. Very complex. The whole verb phrase in African-American English, people just talk about things that are left out. But there are things that are in there that mean, like, yesterday I heard a speaker and she was saying this person uses standard English, but she uses pinna from mm-hmm. Pick Center. Mm-hmm. And the reason is pinna means immediate future, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I pinna go means I'm going right now, soon. You can't leave 2 hours late and say you're going to go. So there are the whole spectrum of things that I was hearing and noticing, and I was so excited about it. Again, that's one of the things that drew me into linguistics. Mm-hmm. And Lubov taught us to really work in the community and listen to what people are saying. I never thought about it, but his stories like August Wilson's. August Wilson tried writing plays with a fancy register, but when he started listening to the way people in Pittsburgh spoke, you know, he said, wait a second, this is really rich. And he put it in all of his 10, his cycle of 10 plays, each referring to different decades of the 20th century. So that's what I've also tried to teach my students, to don't just be introspective. Don't just think you know what people say. What they say is actually more interesting, more complex than anything you can imagine. And that's what that's how I came to love linguistics and how I came to love Black Thought.
Yeah, okay, they're definitely interrelated. I had a similar thing about like the newness of linguistics in comparison to other fields. So that's like, I definitely relate to that. Like, I was like so excited as an undergrad, like, oh, there's all these things we don't know yet. That's how I fell in love too.
So many people I know fell in love with linguistics because of you and your work.
So. Really?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah, and actually, at the LSA Institute in 2015, you did a little talk, and I was there, and I found it very like empowering and invigorating. So thank you for that.
that's encouraging. One of the things I wanted to do was play a couple segments for you, if you don't mind. I don't know how this will work with the mic, but so in that chapter, I refer to a poem by Michael Smith called Nikian, believe it. But that's available on YouTube. So people just put in. I have a reference in the chapter, Michael Smith, Nikian, believe it. It's actually kind of tragic because in the end he was, I think, essentially stoned to death. He was in the wrong political party because of the political situation and he was stoned to death. He was a young, very brilliant person. But in many ways, in terms of nation language or what Edward Cromwell Bradford called nation language, is the language between its rhythm and timbre, its sound explosions, is more like the English of the Caribbean, the Creole English of the Caribbean. You know, Bradford was saying that, you know, we were raised, of course, on British poetry and so on, but the rhythms are very different from one case to the other. But the first example that I want to say that you wouldn't get on the video or on YouTube was a section of a guy they called Plummy Simmons. He was an ordinary, really like a farmer, but he drove a tractor. He did all kinds of things. He worked in the dredges and so on. But he also, on Sunday, he would, at these small prayer meetings, he would say the prayer, because the Fosgay Island where I went to has no bridge to the mainland. So the only way to get there is by boat. So you very, very rarely get a preacher. But people would say these prayers. And this guy gave this prayer one Sunday morning that just amazed me. So I would like to play a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Page 96 of my book.
Walking up and down with a stiff night and a rebellious heart. Please, oh, please, my father, call him, my father, and tell him that the wages of sin is death and the gift of God is eternal life. Tell him, oh, father, that the plain to ride along with poor dead man's home. Make him know, oh, father, that the house is on fire. and the roof is burning down. Let them know, O Father, that you are the God and beside you is mother. Let them know, O Father, that you can defend and you will destroy. And, O Father, let them know, O Father, that when you send me to eat, the two men can come in to rest after you. And, O Father, I know that you are the same God who stands up from the den of the lion.
Okay, Ulysses probably can't understand everything, but this is absolute poetry. He says, tell him that we got some boys and some girls who are walking up and down with a stiff neck and a rebellious heart. But of course, that's what teenagers everywhere are like.
Yes.
Tell them that the train they're riding on is full of dead man's bones. Make them know, our Father, that the house is on fire and the roof is what's burning down. Make them know, our Father, that when you thunder in the east, no man can thunder in the west after you. It's incredible. So it's both the repetition, the drama of the central metaphors. And of course, this is helped by his wife, Agnes, who begins singing to accompany him. You can hear her coming on as he goes on. So I said he's a farmer as well as a poet and a wordsmith. In fact, when he was finished, everybody was just quiet. And he said, that was amazing. And he said, well, you know, I can kick up a little bit of dust as long as I have somebody to stoke the fire and keep me going. He's talking about his wife singing and so on and so forth. This is a very ordinary person who is being poetic and powerful in the way he's using language. Mm-hmm. So you might know, Paula Marshall wrote a piece in the New York Times. She's a Barbadian writer called From the Poets in the Kitchen. She said, you know, her mother and her friends were just domestics in New York, but they would gather in her house every day after work. She said she called them the poets in the kitchen because they would mm-hmm. talk about all kinds of topics in ways that inspired her, and she said made her a writer too. So I guess I'm at the point where people think that you have to get rid of the vernacular. Everyone has to start speaking English, standard English. But in fact, the vernacular has its own riches. And I guess I was trained by people like Blake and like LeBov and my undergraduate teacher was an anthropologist, Roger Keesing, to understand and appreciate the wealth of ordinary language.
I've been thinking a lot about how we train out of kids the way that they their home language when they get to public school. And you wrote a lot about the fight over Ebonics in Oakland schools. I wonder if you see the same thing happening today in schools.
Well, I think the problems still remain. Black schools have been especially bad. Schools, I was reminded of this, in fact, I'm halfway between that and the other topic, looking at schools in Florida. And we had a speaker last night, Nandi Sims, who's been doing work in Florida. And those schools are just terrible. Part of the problem is that the kids do speak the vernacular. Now, depending on the school, the teachers may speak the vernacular too, but they don't systematically take it into account. So there's been work that showed that some kind of contrast, instead of trying to teach entire English grammar, which is what they think they're doing, the number of points at which African American English differ from standard English in a significant way are limited, you know, maybe 25, 30, you know, 40, as against 500 things to be covered in English grammar. And approaches that actually contrast the vernacular with the standard first of all, they're very popular students. And mm-hmm. secondly, they work. Most teachers and members of the public don't understand that. They said, you know, I was asked by Carlin Gettridge, who was superintendent at Oakland back in 1986, you know, to provide some advice and so on. Everybody was saying that it's important for children to learn English and to read English and so on. I say, okay, we all agree on that. The question is how, by what means? Everybody's happy to keep doing the same things we've been doing for decades that aren't working. Why didn't we try some other methods which have worked if we want to get started on a small scale and see how those work more effectively? So Oakland was trying to do more vernacular things. I think a lot of it has stopped now. A lot of people have left the district and have retired and so on and so forth. But I think you do need to do something that excites students and gets them on board. I'm not sure if I did in this book, but elsewhere I've contrasted some work done by a student called Norma Pystrup, back down at Stanford. I just discovered it on the shelves. It was amazing. She contrasted a teacher who she called interrupting teacher. This was a teacher who every time you made a quote-unquote mistake, she would interrupt you and correct you. And children withdrew from participation because everything they said was met with criticism and insult. Whereas the black artful teacher would ignore a lot of that and build on their enthusiasm and got them interested and excited. And when you actually look at test scores, the children being taught by the artful teacher were doing much better than the children who were taught by the interrupting teacher. Nicole Hannah-Jones has pointed out that in many ways, segregation has increased.
Yes.
The last 20 years. And schools have gotten worse and worse. And she's pointed to the difficulties that schools are having. And it's probably a lone voice in the wilderness. So anyhow, schools in general are bad, especially in black neighborhoods. Now, you want me to talk about the other issue. the trial Rachel Zontel and so on. Very, very powerful thing, because the point is, she was talking to Trayvon Martin throughout this encounter. The killing of Emmett Till, as I point out, who was 14 years old, only 14, by the way, 1955, by Ron Bryant in Milan, the two white men who brutally murdered him, and because they said he had made some comment on the wife, shop owner's wife, which she later, by the way, said was not true.
Yeah.
But that whole incident, nobody witnessed it or heard it. So in this case, Zontel, Richard Zontel, was talking to Trayvon Martin on his cell phone. So she was hearing everything. So she was a direct witness to everything that happened until his struggle with George Zimmerman, where the microphone was knocked from his mouth and, you know, she couldn't hear it. But she was a really important witness. She spent 6 hours on the stand. She should have been considered highly credible, but she wasn't. And I think this is largely because she spoke in this deep vernacular. So her mother is Haitian, and she speaks, by the way, Haitian Creole fluently to her mother. I went to her home. Her mother speaks in fluent Haitian Creole. Her father is from the Dominican Republic, so he speaks Spanish. So he speaks some Spanish. So she's 10 times more multilingual than the average person in the United States. And yet people castigated her because of her vernacular. They said that she was stupid and ignorant. And the jury basically didn't believe her. So he got to meet Rachel Zontel. And I have a picture of that at our first meeting. And then basically I started teaching her to read by Skype and by FaceTime and so on and so forth. The only thing she wanted to read about was black history. So she wanted to read, you know, stories of black characters and so on. And then she actually wrote these words about I did a little kind of poem, and I have that on page 168. He said, sadly, a young soul had to die, by Richard Rantel. My mindset yesterday, every day is, I defeated yesterday, I elevated today, I control tomorrow. I said this because it became a routine. You see, behind this smile, I'm a black woman who society feels threatened by and perceived as ghetto. You don't know why we feel pain just like anyone else. They ask, what do we want? In other words, why can't you shut the hell up and accept the way things are? Mm-hmm. Accept in this, that society will now truly view as equal. Sadly, a young soul had to die for me to open my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
She's referring, of course, to Trayvon Martin. So I think he's just one example of a person who received a very poor education in Florida schools, and apparently that's still the case. I showed in other papers that the achievement level of people in the class was comparable to hers, and if probably almost any other person would have spoken as she did and would have fared as well as she did. And I fear that until more is done for speakers like that and for community members like that, particularly in Florida, but in many other parts of the country, you're not going to see the kind of achievement and upliftment that's needed throughout the country. I could go on and on about that, but I don't want to be speaking on a soapbox.
I'm complete agreement with you. It's a huge crisis, and more people should, one, know about it, and two, care that it's happening.
Yes, because the alternative to this is, of course, when people don't have an education, the alternative is going to be jail. That's not a promising alternative.
Yes, the school-to-prison pipeline is quite strong. We would love it if you would share with us what you feel is one of the most important things you've learned over the course of your career as a linguist.
In 2 minutes, let me see. The first thing is that, contrary to popular impression, all languages are structured. But the way I sometimes put it to students in this way, if languages were not regular and structured, you couldn't learn them.
Yeah.
That is, if I could just decide that I would call a book a blagu, and you call it a book, and so on, we could never communicate, much less if our phonemes and our morphemes and our syntax was that variable. And the things that always excite me about language is finding in it structures and patterns that we are totally unaware of.
Same.
So when people say that vernacular languages have no structure or no regularity, that's just nonsense. And because of the fact they're structured, you can use that fact to build on it a vehicle for teaching them other languages or other varieties of language. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. But if you just dismiss just say, don't want to hear any vernacular, it'll never work. I mentioned a couple of days ago, in fact, the Nanny Sims, the bridge readers, which were developed by Houghton Mifflin, they would use deep Arab vernacular in the first series, and then they would have intermediate vernacular, and then they would have the standard. Those bridge readers were written up in, I think it was Newsweek or Time magazine years ago. A person was writing about how wonderful they are. Look at the success they're having. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the reaction to that was, what? They're using vernacular in the schools? Yeah. No. So in fact, the reaction to that had the effect of killing the bridge readers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Houghton Mifflin said, we don't think we'll actually go ahead with this project because there's a lot of community negativity about this. And so the project was very promising at the time, was killed. There are some new efforts to do creative things, but you always face this very negative reaction, what they call the negativity of the uninformed. Yeah. Who know so much, but they don't know anything. Yeah. And their premises are all wrong. And so let's just keep doing exactly what we've been doing for decades and decades, which things don't work. Whereas there are other up, and it's the same way, by the way, in the West Indies, you know, not just talking about America. You know, people would say, any idea of taking fuel in the account in teaching, no, be bad for the kids. That's what LePage came up against when he was trying to make these suggestions. And I argue that you may find that a wild or crazy idea, but the idea of kids and students failing in large numbers is worse.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So if you take that into account, you would be convinced that you need to do more and to try new things.
It's like that Simpsons meme. We've tried nothing and we're all out of ideas.
Yeah, and you see children failing in large numbers. It's not the children at that point. It is the system.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Well, this has been such a great conversation. Thank you
such
so much.
Such an honor.
Thank you for coming on.
Oh, it was a delight. It was really fun talking to you all.
Great.
It was so lovely.
And we always leave our listeners with one final message. Don't be an asshole.
Don't be a linguistic asshole, at least.
Exactly.
Yes.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.